and I'm excited to tell you about Project Premonition, which somehow relates mosquitoes, drones, and Azure in the same deck. I want to try to save time for questions because I usually get lots of cool questions when I give this talk. So there should be some microphones floating around at the end, and please save your crazy questions because they're fun to talk about. Okay, so to tell you what Project Premonition is about, we have to talk about emerging infectious diseases a bit because it's about a technology to try to stop them. So an emerging infectious disease is a disease whose prevalence has increased in around the last 20 years in some place. They include diseases that we've known about before, most recently Ebola, for example. We knew there was Ebola, but we didn't expect it to show up in West Africa. We knew there was chikungunya. We didn't expect to show up in the Caribbean in 2014 and then show up in Florida, for example. Then there are diseases that pop up that we didn't even know existed before. These are things like SARS and MERS. Like most infectious diseases, you know, they threaten our health. They do damage to our economies, to our societies. But unlike other infectious diseases, they're particularly unpredictable. And that's what makes them difficult to manage. So if you look at, you know, some of the recent cases of disease emergence and sort of just take an estimate of the cost to economy, society of those diseases and the number of cases, even when those cases are small, you see how difficult it is to deal with them. For instance, I'll just focus on Ebola. In the US, there are 4 cases of Ebola. And those came to the US from Africa, from people working in Africa. But that the uncertainty surrounded with what would Ebola do in the US led to $2.8 billion in funding in the omnibus 2015 spending bill for 4 cases that showed up in the US. So that gives you a sense of what do you do when you have something like that at your doorstep and you don't really know, is it gonna spread? Is it contained? How do we deal with it? So really the best thing you can do is to figure out the problem as soon as possible. This is what most health organizations do today. They call this disease surveillance or pathogen surveillance. They put systems in place to try to detect when something is gonna happen before it gets bad. Because when an epidemic starts, it's typically exponentially more expensive to stop it in time. And then oftentimes there reaches a point where you just can't stop it. For these emerging infectious diseases though, they're particularly difficult to surveil for a few reasons. So one of them is that between 60 and 75% of these diseases come from animals. They're harbored in animals, they evolve in animals, and then they pop out from animals in unexpected ways. So they're very difficult to see when you surveil, let's say, people going into the hospital, or you know, news feeds that talk about sort of aggregate, let's say, flu-like symptoms in some area, which has been done in the past. Existing systems detect outbreaks about 2 weeks after they happen, which in most epidemiological models is oftentimes too late to stop an epidemic if the disease is going to reach that level. What makes them particularly challenging, as I said before, is that many of these diseases were just unknown to science before. So how do you monitor something which you didn't even know existed? In fact, as we learn more about viruses, for example, we now know that if you take just about anything, you put it in a gene sequencer and you ask what are the viruses in that material that I just sequenced. About 70% of them will be unknown. This is pretty new knowledge to science that most of the viruses on the planet we didn't know existed before. So when we talk about surveilling emerging infectious diseases, we're talking about something that tries to address these problems, which are pretty difficult. What we're really talking about is a system that would ideally tell you what kind of potential pathogens are involving in the animal population in the wild. If you could know that, then you could watch the evolution of things that don't yet impact us. You could watch their epidemiology, and you could start to estimate risk before it reaches a point where an unexpected outbreak happens. So Project Premonition is about doing exactly that. It sort of stands for something, preventative monitoring of infectious agents, if you highlight the right letters in there. But the basic idea is you want to know what's floating around in an animal. Animals, they don't show up to doctors. They don't really like us interacting with them. But nature actually provides an insect, which is really good at finding animals hidden in the wild, sneaking up on them and sampling their blood, and that's the mosquito. Mosquitoes are on every continent except Antarctica. They can fly about 10 miles, they live about 20 days. On average, they consume about 2.5 microliters of blood. So when they bite an animal, for us, for example, they carry with that a sample. That sample will last in them for some amount of time, during which they digest it, and a few days later, you won't be able to detect anything. But if you catch them soon after they've bitten something, they have a little DNA sample inside their body. And so the idea is to use mosquitoes at scale to get a sense of what kind of pathogens are moving around in the environment. This reduces the problem from looking at, you know, this wide range of animals, trying to find these wide range of animals, to finding these mosquitoes. Now, does this idea work? It turns out that experiments on mosquitoes of this sort have been done for the last few years now, where someone takes a mosquito, basically you smush it up, it's slightly unpleasant, and then you put the result of that into a gene sequencer, and that gene sequencer converts all of the genes sitting in this mosquito, which includes its own genes, but also whatever is in whatever else is in its body, into data. And then you can look at that data. You can ask, what did the mosquito bite? We call that the host. And you will see things like humans, ducks, geese, cows, plants. They even bite lizards, it turns out, bite just about everything. And you will also find viruses and bacteria in them that mosquitoes are known to transmit, but you'll also see things that they're not known to transmit because they encountered it through the host that they've bitten. So if you can get mosquitoes, this reduces the problem from finding animals in the environment to catching mosquitoes. Now, it turns out that this is a problem that has been pretty well studied for the last 60 years because mosquitoes are a primary vector for a number of nasty diseases like dengue fever, like malaria. So entomologists have developed methods to catch them and use them to understand the spread of these mosquito-borne pathogens. Current technology, though, is pretty simple. And you're seeing an example of that on the screen. This is actually a modern mosquito trap. We bought this a few months ago. It's called a CDC light trap. Basically, it's a big net. Underneath that black thing is a little fan and light bulb. You plug this up to a car battery, and over this, you hang that igloo there, full of dry ice. The dry ice evaporates, it creates a CO2 plume, and that's what attracts most of these biting insects. They fly near this device, the fan sucks them into this net. You leave that there for 12 to 18 hours, come back the next day, you collect it back, and in there, you hopefully have a bunch of mosquitoes. So that's the state of the art right now for catching, you know, biting insects. It actually works pretty well, but it's, as I'll show you, not high throughput enough to do what we want to do, which is really to collect them at scale. Currently, studies like this are done at pretty low scale because dealing with a trap like this is pretty expensive and time-consuming. So part of what we have to do is reinvent these basic technologies. So the key innovations to make something like premonition work are to sort of re-examine this pipeline that entomologists use to study mosquitoes, try to make it high throughput and lower cost so that we can use it for a slightly different purpose, which is to see the environment through what the mosquito has sampled. So the first place we need to innovate is on the trap design. To take it from that thing I just showed you in the previous slide to something which is essentially a field deployable robot. It does a lot of what a biologist would do today, but it does it on its own autonomously. So what I mean by that is that it will do a few things. It will actually identify the kind of insect flying around and entering this trap, and if it's one that's interesting, it catches it. So it has enough intelligence to tell things apart, to distinguish, let's say, a mosquito from a non-mosquito in real time. Because it can do this, it can do a lot of other things. It can store data about each sample it's decided to collect, data like what the insect sounded like, humidity, temperature, a lot of information that helps you understand when these things show up in the environment. The other thing it does is it starts to replace signal processing with actuation. So in that previous slide, you saw that this thing has to have a car battery to power it, and that's because it's actuating constantly, whether there's a bug showing up or not. And this device will replace that constant actuation with sensing, so it only makes a movement when something interesting happens. And that's much more power efficient than actuating constantly. You know, I think of it like a frog doesn't just jump around with its mouth open, it waits till it sees an insect, and then it expends the energy to catch something. So it's basically the same idea. Now, if we get that right, the next thing we want to solve is putting these into the environment at scale. It turns out that just doing that, even if you sort of ignore the how you have to manage this trap, is itself a low throughput process. Somebody in a rural environment has to literally hike out into a jungle and put one of these things out. Or in an urban environment, you typically want to find a place which is, let's say, secure, but still near an urban population where you're interested in collecting. And that's also challenging. It means, let's say, putting something on the top of a building or, you know, around a fence. In both situations, it takes quite a long time to do this. And of course, you have to go back and get it the next day. So your time is doubled. And here we're looking at autonomous drone deployment so that you can deploy these into the environment and collect them back quickly. And then the final thing is, you know, how do you analyze these mosquitoes that you got back? I said in the beginning that there will be a number of interesting things that are unknown to science. How do you build a test for something which is unknown to science? You know, if you go to a doctor's office, they test for something specific. It's been worked out how you test for that. Here we're going to leverage the incredible Moore's law, actually faster than Moore's law, decrease in the cost of gene sequencing, which basically can turn a biological sample into data. And once you turn it into data, you can ask all sorts of questions about it. You can ask, is it similar to something that I know about, a pathogen that I know about? Similarity is a very interesting algorithmic problem to define. But basically, the gene sequencer gives us a whole new set of algorithms that we can throw at this problem, which differ from the traditional sort of laboratory testing you would do. Right, so those are the three sort of the three technical innovations that I'll dig into in the rest of this talk. So the round trip idea is basically this. You have animals in the environment, all sorts of things are going on in those animals. Mosquitoes are happily flying around this environment, tracking them down and sampling DNA and RNA from them. We want to be able to deploy devices into and out of the environment that will catch these things at mosquitoes at scale. At low cost. Of course, we will need to do this over larger ranges. We can talk more about how you can accomplish that. Once you get these things back, you take the mosquitoes, you gene sequence them, which is essentially a standard process now. There's a machine that does it. That converts mosquitoes to data. And then what you would like to get is a map in space of genes in space and time to see what sort of potentially pathogenic genes are moving in space and time, and how they're correlated with hosts. So if we get this all right, you know, we would like to be able to do something like this. On the left-hand side, you have these little green squares representing some interesting host genes. These are what the mosquitoes are biting. On the right side, some interesting possible pathogenic genes, and you would like to find a correlation in space and time that sort of shows you the movement of something that you would not otherwise see in the environment. Okay, so the first thing we have to ask is this all science fiction? To answer that question, we worked with the country of Grenada to go there and try this manually to test whether this was science fiction or not. So, you know, the first thing we realized is that there are parts of this problem that are outside the core expertise of Microsoft research, like field entomology, molecular biology. And so the first thing we did was to find a really great team, and I just want to give them mention here, that includes experts in these fields that that are really key to a project like this. So we rounded up these experts. They include people in aerospace, entomology, metagenomic viral discovery, hardware, even odorants, new kind of odor attractants for mosquitoes. We gathered these people up. We worked with the island of Grenada, and we took them to Grenada. And we said, let's try the following thing. Let's try to cover Grenada at the temporal spatial granularity we would like to do with a drone, but let's do it manually with existing trap designs. Every place that we do this, we will fly a drone around where we place this trap so that we can see what a drone would see if it were placing that trap itself. So we can later go back and try to teach a drone. So this is really a data collection mission to see if this plays out like we imagine. On the left-hand side, you see the planned sites that we intended to visit in Grenada. These are 50 sites. On the right-hand side, you see what we actually visited over a five-day period. This is, in fact, 30 sites, and then some we collected more than once. The thing to point out is that in 5 days, we could not visit 50 sites. And this is an island which is 133 square miles with actually quite good infrastructure. So that just gives you a sense of how difficult this is to do manually, even if you sort of throw cost out of the door. So what happened? Each day, several times a day, we trek out to some place. This is Doug, expert in field entomology. He picks a location where we would hang a trap. We would hang traps in environments of all sorts. So the other good thing about Grenada is that in a small geography, it represents many kinds of microenvironments. We put traps in jungles, we put traps in beaches, even in urban environments, people were kind enough to let us come in and put them, you know, over their washing machine. The really great folks there. The point being to get as much data as possible about what you would see if you did this at scale. Every place that we put this trap, we would fly a particular drone profile around the site. We do this because we know from existing data that even though you think mosquitoes are everywhere, they actually aren't. It really matters even in, let's say, 10 square meters where you place one of these devices. If it's in a place that's too windy, if it's in a place that has fast-moving water versus slow-moving water or not the right prey around, you actually won't catch any mosquitoes. This trap will show up with zero mosquitoes in it, even though you left it out for 18 hours. So we already knew this, and that's why every place we would put a trap, we would fly this drone. So this drone can really gather video data, very fine-grained video data about that, you know, 10 square meters, roughly. The flight pattern was a little bigger, but roughly in that scale, so that we can correlate that fine-grained data back with what we saw in those traps. Once we would do that, we would so those would sit in the environment for 12 to 18 hours. We go to bed, wake up really early, pick up the ones that were left out from the day before. Then Doug Norris would open this trap, and he would get a pile of bugs that looked like that. This is actually a small pile. Sometimes the piles were bigger. Why is there a pile of bugs like that? Because a lot of things are attracted to CO2 and light. And he would then pick out what the mosquitoes were. So about 95% of the biomass in this trap is uninteresting from what we want to use, from, you know, what we're trying to study. It's only those subset of mosquitoes. And again, this is how it works today. So you need an expert in entomology who can tell the difference between a mosquito and a non-mosquito at the very least. Actually, I was surprised at how many things look like mosquitoes that aren't. There are actually a lot of things that look like a mosquito. So this would be at another few hours, again, with a trained expert who does this all the time. Doug goes to Africa and studies malaria. Once we get those mosquitoes back, here comes the squishing part. We took them to a lab in St. George's University. They get squished. We extract both DNA and RNA. DNA tends to tell you information about what a mosquito bit. RNA tends to tell you more information about a certain kind of virus, a certain class of viruses that would be in a mosquito called RNA viruses. So we extract both of those. And then in the end, we put them through a gene sequencer. And just to give you kind of a preview, the things in red are the rough proportion of RNA in DNA that correspond to viruses and bacteria. After you do this process, so you see there's a reasonably large percentage, particularly given that the genes and viruses are quite small. You know, they're exponentially smaller than our genes. So the data in that about viruses is much less compared to the total data you get. The other is stuff that we have no idea what it is, and it makes up most of the sample. The biologists that we work with who do virus discovery, they can look at that and tell you that a large percentage of that, let's say, is additional viruses. But if you put it through an existing algorithmic tool today, it will not be able to tell you that because these are currently unknown to science. So that's one of the things we have to fix. Okay, so we did that experiment, and I think what it validated was, you know, a lot of what we imagined, that the throughput for ignoring cost, go into the field, catch mosquitoes, bring them back, and analyze them, is about 6 traps per day in an environment that has good infrastructure. And that's not very much. What we would like to imagine is, let's say, 100 traps a day in a 500 square mile area. That would cover a large city if you could do that. So today, this really is not possible, even if you ignore cost. But what we did validate as well is that you can get mosquitoes back, and you can see interesting things in them. So from there, we started chewing on the technical problems. How do we innovate in the right ways to get the scale that we want while keeping costs low? So the first thing we did was to re-examine the basic mosquito trap. I think of this actually sort of analogously to how Nest reinvented the thermostat. Who thought the thermostat was something you could reinvent? But it turns out you can. In much the same way, these very fundamental devices that are used by public health organizations all over the world to tell us things about malaria, about dengue, all of these nasty viruses and diseases, they haven't changed in the last 60 years. So there's a lot of space to make them better. The basic design that we started to prototype was this sort of honeycomb design. Each one of these honeycombs is this independent sensing and actuating cell. What it uses is an IR emitter on the top of the cell and a phototransistor at the bottom to listen using sound to what's entering this this cell. So basically, when an insect flies through and it occludes this light, it does that in a pattern which essentially translates to sound, even though you're listening to it with light. And the insect doesn't see this kind of light because it's in the infrared range. Every one of these cells is wired to a microprocessor at the top of this device, which is doing real-time microprocessing on 64 channels to try to detect, is something that just entered something I want to catch, or is it, you know, a beetle or a shadow? So we're talking about handling 64 input channels in real time. Because if you wait too long, your bug flies out. The cool thing about this design is that every cell works independently, so you don't get this big soup of bugs, whether you get each bug nicely closed into a cell, which can be extracted and processed in a high throughput way. And for every bug you caught, you have a recording that tells you what it sounded like and what conditions the environment was in when you caught it. And that can allow you to start to refine the trap. For instance, if it's catching too many things that you're not interested in, you can start to train it using classical machine learning techniques, for example. It now has that feedback mechanism built in. So that's the design. How did we test this design? Well, I went to a kind laboratory who gave me a box of malaria mosquitoes. These are uninfected, but they're the kind of mosquitoes that transmit malaria in India, kind of anopheles. And actually, I turned my office into a small jungle for about a month. And in that tank are 300 malaria mosquitoes flying through these sensors. And basically, this was a preliminary test to figure out what kind of sensors do we need to build, what kind of algorithms do we need to build to detect when something is moving through them. From there, we ended up building our version 1 prototype. Actually, this is a demo we gave in DC. So standing out here are some congresspersons and senators. Watching a bunch of malaria mosquitoes in a very nice venue flying into this trap. In the center of this trap sits dry ice, which again provides a CO2 plume. Mosquitoes are drawn towards the dry ice. It actually turns out they're also drawn towards the color of this trap. When they enter this little cell, if the cell decides it's a mosquito, this door closes, and you can see on the right-hand side there, two mosquitoes got trapped in that cell. Each cell itself is just plastic and a spring, so it's very low cost. They're removable, and they carry with them none of the electronics, which are the more expensive parts. Actually, more expensive relatively, because we also designed the electronics to be low cost so that we can build these out at scale. IR emitters and phototransistors are low cost, and we designed the algorithms to run on low-cost microprocessors. So now mosquitoes fly in, you get them nicely packaged, other things are ignored. We started looking at autonomous deployment. You know, one thing that really struck us when we went to a country like Grenada and we flew drones around is commodity drones have a lot of capabilities, but you really have to do a lot to make them work autonomously such that you have the safety and robustness requirements so that they don't crash, you know, on people's heads. They don't crash into buildings. So there's a whole level of a software stack that needs to be added into a commodity drone to give that level of safe and robust autonomy. And that really struck us when we went to Grenada and we manually flew drones, let's say in an urban environment like you saw. I mean, people come out, they look at them, they're interested, and here we have an expert pilot who's piloting it. But to do this scale, you can't have an expert pilot. You can't have a pilot per drone, because then again, you have a person per sample. So what we've been doing is taking a lot of the research that came from Microsoft Research and secure operating systems to make sure you can't hack a drone, in programming language design and verification and validation to make them more programmable while being able to find bugs before you deploy the system, all the way up to vision and machine learning so that a drone can consume what it's seeing and make decisions about it. I can't even go into all of the technical details because that will be a few more talks, but I think what's really exciting is because Microsoft has always been challenged to make Windows as robust as possible, make it as secure as possible, it turns out we have a lot of technologies that have probably been developed over the last 10 to 20 years, in fact, that we can now start to turn around and ask how would they work to make something like a drone safe and robust so it can do something autonomously at scale. This is just focusing on the vision part. So this is a drone flight in Grenada where we caught the most nasty mosquitoes. What the drone can actually see is that it's flying over a mangrove swamp. In another part of the video, you would see specular reflections of the stagnant water underneath of these trees. It's also observing that there are these dilapidated vehicles because this is an auto mechanic next to the mangrove swamp. There's a pig farm and a restaurant. So it turns out that there are a lot of interesting things going on in this one spot. We caught a lot of mosquitoes there, and that's what a drone can see. From that drone image, we can actually reconstruct a 3D model of the environment in which it flew. We can reconstruct even the drone trajectory and camera poses. And now we can start to correlate this data with the number of mosquitoes that we caught at each site. And that starts to give us a classifier so that now the drone can go into the environment and make those decisions about where to place, where to spend the energy to sample. Okay, and then I wanna go, I should just check on my time here. Okay, so then we got these mosquitoes back. From Grenada, we have real data sets. And the final thing we need to ask is, can we really start to take this data and pull out of it the interesting information, the host that a mosquito has encountered, the possible pathogens? This is a super interesting algorithmic problem, and it's something that needs cloud-scale computing to work because the quantity of data is so huge. So just to put that in perspective, here I say 2 gigabytes. What we really saw is that from one of those traps, we would get about 200 gigabytes of raw data coming off of a gene sequencer. Existing metagenomic studies would take that 200 gigabytes, refine it down to about 100 megabytes, and at that point, a human, a biologist, will start to inspect that 100 megabytes of data to pull out the interesting, the interesting bits, and then do laboratory studies to follow up on them. So 200 gigabytes to 100 megabytes, it's still good, but at scale, it's not good enough. We really need something that is going to take this huge amount of data and raise the red flags with low false positives. So the framework that we are developing basically has three parts to it, and I go from left to right because the ones on the left are easier. As you go towards the right, they get harder to do. So on the left, you have this 200 gigabytes of genetic data you squeeze out of mosquitoes, and you want to know what did the mosquito bite, or what kind of mosquito was it. So this we call host and vector identification. The way you do this is that you look at the segments of this genetic data that matches closely to known, let's say, mammals. And there aren't that many mammals on the planet. So this is fairly effective. Now you go one level deeper and you want to say, what are the bacteria or the viruses that this mosquito encountered? Now it's a lot harder because, as we saw, most of these things are unknown. So there's a whole other set of algorithms that are still being developed to try to tell you, do I see something that looks like a virus that might be dangerous? Now, what if you see genes where you don't even know it's a virus, you don't know it's a bacteria, what can you know about it? Well, the final thing you can know about a gene is the proteins that it codes for. So the protein is kind of the little machines, the biological machines that our genes build. So the hardest thing you could probably do is to try to ask, what is this protein doing? which is also a very interesting set of algorithms, but computationally the hardest. And so we've been looking at, the, from left to right, how you do each of these steps at scale, at cloud scale, so you can handle this level of data. What we've been able to see so far is that we can kind of do the natural thing. We can recover what kind of mosquito we caught. In this case, this funny diagram is showing you the 200 gigabytes of raw data on that blue arc. It's drawing lines between the subset of that data and genes in known mosquitoes. So you see most of these lines go to one arc, which is a kind of mosquito called Culex, in the genus Culex. And that turns out that's what we caught, as corroborated by our entomologist who identified them by morphology. We can also start to tell what the mosquitoes have bitten. So in this picture, again, you see the 200 gigabytes of data. You see that a small subset of that 200 gigabytes of data is recognized as host data, as telling you this came from the genes of a host. In this case, the host that we see the most genes from is a human host. So we're seeing a subset of a human genome here, which isn't so surprising because there are a lot of mammals in Grenada, and mosquitoes are pretty good at biting us. But we can start to pull that out of this large amount of data. And then the final thing that we can do is we can start to recover viruses. In fact, we can even start to recover novel viruses from these mosquitoes. So this funny diagram is showing you a computationally reconstructed candidate Culex flavivirus. A flavivirus is a family of viruses that are mosquito-borne and infect humans. This is not a known one, but it is known that all flaviviruses infect some other mammal, some other animal as they go from mosquito to host. So this is a virus in the wild that hasn't been seen before. It certainly infects something. It's not known that it's infecting humans, but this is one of those interesting cases where you might would want to ask the question, what is the host of this thing? Is it a dog? A lot of people live with dogs in Grenada. Is it a rodent? Is it a monkey? There are some monkeys there, but not so many. Those questions you can now start to answer once you can collect data like this at scale. And it's something you would want to raise up as a red flag. And you see it's a very small slice of this large data set. So it's very interesting how you start to develop algorithms to pull this out without manual inspection. Let me talk about the path ahead. So how far off is something like this? I think realistically, doing something like this at scale is easily 5 years off. Maybe it's longer, but I would say 5 years. We've been doing this now for a year. But I think what's certainly clear are the technology trends. These are ripe for disruption in this space of understanding the environment better. And the three technology trends that I think are absolutely clear are first Moore's Law in microprocessing. It means we can make devices smarter and cheaper. We can have them do things that you couldn't imagine them doing before, and it doesn't make it so expensive that it throws it off the table. The second one, is the Cambrian explosion of commodity drones and robotics. Now, for reasonable cost, a drone of reasonable quality will cost about $1,500 US. What can that thing do? It can go 40 miles an hour. It can go very high. You're not supposed to fly that high, but it can go quite high and reasonably far. So at that cost level, you can really imagine buying a bunch of those and having them do something at scale. The hard part, though, of course, is making sure that they do that safely and robustly. But this Cambrian explosion is here to stay. These commodity robotic platforms are not going to go anywhere. They will be around. And then I think the final interesting technology trend is this exponential decrease in cost of gene sequencing. When I talk to some crowds about this project, they say gene sequencing isn't that $1 billion step. It was 20 years ago. In 2006, I think, 2007, it cost $10 million to sequence your genome. Today, it costs $5,000. So the decrease in cost is faster than the decrease in cost of microprocessors. What it means is that you have a single machine that basically automates all laboratory steps. You put sample in, you get data out, it turns it into a computational problem. This trend is clear, it's commoditized already. So I think when you put these three things together, It's hard to predict exactly how far out this is, but when you have such strong trends converging in the right way, sort of my assumption is it will happen one way or another. So thank you. I might have gone slightly. Oh, we actually have a lot of time for questions. I get all kinds of interesting questions. What do mosquitoes bite? What do they like to smell? how do you sequence something? So please give me any kind of question. Oh, we got one right here. Yeah, so that's a great question. In many ways, the technology stack I talked about for drones is generic. It's not specifically tailored for placing a mosquito trap in the environment, but what it's designed to do is to move safely and robustly in an unstructured environment. If that unstructured environment is urban, it has some specific challenges. If it's a jungle, it has some other specific challenges. But once you have that technology stack, you can use it for many different purposes. Both satellite-level and drone-level imagery are being used to improve agriculture, to monitor health of species. I don't specifically recall an example where it's being used to monitor invasive species, but definitely they have been used to monitor endangered species. Particularly like birds where you can see their nests, for example. So you're absolutely right. Once you get the technology right, it enables, I think, many applications, many types of data that you would like to get from the environment, which right now are just too expensive to get. Right. Great point.
Obviously, the project needed lots of resources. How much money have you spent on this project?
So,
what's the
this is the question I never answer. I mean, so let's see. So Microsoft Research, we're about 1,000 PhD researchers. The way we work as a laboratory is actually in many ways bottom up. We have the freedom to sort of come together and coalesce around something exciting. And that's sort of how we work. We don't typically work by sort of saying, this is the budget that we need. But we work around, I think, projects that inspire us. So it's actually even hard for me to tell you a number. But I think what I can say is that there's a lot of excitement in Microsoft and MSR around where these technologies are going. There are groups that work on, for instance, just computational genomics in the cloud. We have groups that work on just making an operating system as safe and secure as possible. So we have this diverse set of technologies that have been developed for many different purposes, for many angles, sometimes for 20 years. Take operating system, for example. As long as Microsoft has always had to think about operating systems, MSR has always had some people focusing on how you make operating systems better. So that's sort of what sits inside of our umbrella. It's a very exciting umbrella to be in. And the way that we coalesce around a project is really in kind of a bottom-up way. What sort of inspires us all in some time horizon? So it's a bit difficult to state a concrete number. In this space, there are about, I would say internally from drones to biology to programming languages, about 10 researchers in MSR who are working on this. And then we have a set of wonderful academic collaborators outside of MSR that provide the sort of expertise that's farther away from the tech that we normally think about.
Got a question for you.
Yeah.
Regarding expense and cost. Just curious to the mortality rate of your drones due to
Right.
the malfunction of local citizens not happy with the drone flying around. Do you have any numbers on how many times you had to repair them or replace them?
Yeah, so we don't have numbers on that yet because You know, at this point, we really can't fly drones fully autonomously. I mean, for two reasons. One is there's still a lot of research to do. I think, you know, we will be sort of at a proving ground phase in not too long. But the other part of that is regulatory requirements. In many countries, those are changing very rapidly. So in the US, for example, you can't just go out and fly a drone autonomously. I mean, even on Microsoft campus, for instance, we cannot just arbitrarily go out and fly a drone. So that sort of means we don't fly over people's houses and make them unhappy and they shoot our drone down. But it also means that there's a longer lead time to go from, you know, the kind of algorithms that we believe will make the thing robust and safe to really showing that it's robust and safe. You know, the way we're viewing it is, if you take commercial aviation, which has, you know, pretty long product life cycles, they have very high software quality they have to meet before they can release a product. If you take commodity drones, which are mainly targeting the hobby market, they have very, very short product life cycles, but they don't have to meet that very high bar that commercial aerospace has to meet. What I sort of expect is that gap will close, both in the sense of regulation and the required software quality. But we'll still want time to market to be short. So what we have to figure out is, how do we close that gap while still being able to, you know, update a drone every 6 months, update its control software every 6 months, which is something that's sort of unheard of in commercial aerospace, where that software has to be very heavily certified. So at this point, we're not flying them over people's houses, but that's what we're thinking about as we move towards that direction. Let's make sure that we get it right and we don't run into these issues when we start to do testing out in the wild. Yeah, it's an important question though. Yeah.
Presumably you're thinking about deploying these traps autonomously.
Right.
How are you going to get them down to the ground through the jungle canopy?
Yeah.
Thinking, how are you moving back?
Right. So yeah, that's a great question. So we've talked to a number of different engineers about this. You know, one recommendation is don't actually go through the canopy. So in many cases, you know, you have a clearing, and you can, if your drone is small, that's actually the advantage of these fairly small drones, is they can go down when you have a small clearing. We tried to gather this data in Grenada. How many places did we sample where there wasn't an access like that? In the jungle conditions, most of the places we sampled, you know, the canopy is reasonably, it's not sparse, but in the range where you want to be, there's a clearing. So I think probably the best thing to do is try to find these clearings, which goes to the point why the sort of vision data that we collected is so useful. Because it's what helps us to build those classifiers. A drone actually has to know in an unmapped environment where is there a clearing? What is a space that's safe to land in? What's a space that's too dangerous to land in? Now, in terms of the mechanism that would detach a trap from a drone, that's still something that we're investigating. There are a few different designs you could imagine. One, that the drone just stays attached to the trap, carrying enough battery reserve that it can get out. Another is that it places a trap and somehow the trap can lift off the ground or it comes back to retrieve it. So there are different options there. There's sort of cost-benefit trade-offs. There are analogous problems in classical aerospace problems where you have to drop a package off to the ground, catch it back up. There are all sorts of interesting mechanisms to do that. We haven't entirely converged on what the best way is to do it for this scenario. But probably we all agree that trying to really fly down directly through a dense canopy would be the last one we want to try. Yeah, that's a great question.
Yeah, hi. There's actually been quite a lot of research and development on operating systems for autonomous flying of low-cost drones.
Right.
Otago University, a guy called Nick Sherlock has been developing secure operating systems just for drones. Were you aware of the work that's been done? Some of it's been commercialized.
Yeah, so, right, you're absolutely right. There's a... In the operating system space, you know, there's work on operating systems that are particularly secure, operating systems that are real-time, provide you higher-level programming languages. There's certainly a lot of work in that space. The operating system that we're looking at has been around, has been developed, I would say, for the last, on the order of 8 years, and fits exactly kind of in that space that you just described. Of course, where it started from was traditional desktop software. With the goal of making the desktop operating system safe and secure. I think what it has that other newer secure operating systems don't have is a pretty large suite of manually verified operating system components. These include things like communication components, protocols that are part of the operating system, that work with the operating system, but aren't in the OS itself. So when you think about operating system, there's the microkernel, but then there's all of the other stuff you need around it, the wireless stack, if you're communicating wirelessly, the file system. So the particular OS that we're looking at came from the desktop world. Because it's been studied, again, like I said, for around 8 years or so, it has a pretty large database of components which have been manually verified. It means that for every component, there's a specification that has been written, and then that specification goes through, with the assistance of a person, a set of tools that check that the software meets that specification in a mathematical way. But the work you mentioned is certainly related. I think it's great that the research community as a whole is really taking this problem on. How do we make things like drones as safe as possible? And we're using our OS, but I'm glad to know that other groups are pushing on the problem as well. Yeah. Right. So yeah, in the space of OSs, you know, there's lots of different of real-time OSs on drones. There's lots of different directions the research comes from. Some come from the perspective of proving functional correctness of the OS, and that's where we come from. Some come from the perspective of making the OS correct with respect to real-time properties, because when you run software on a drone, you have to be sure that it runs the software in a predictable, timely way. So there's a whole bunch of different sort of research subgenres in the space of operating systems. We sit in a particular one, but you're right, there's definitely a lot of work on it. I think all of them have to move in some way or another to solve the right set of problems for drones. We happen to be moving from an operating system that is not real time, but is garbage collected, memory safe, and has a lot of a suite of proven protocols that already come along with it. And so our challenge is moving that to a place where you have stronger real time properties, so that the controllers work at the in a timely way. Yeah.
Flying drones over anywhere is potentially invasive as far as privacy is concerned.
Yeah.
What sort of work would you have to do with the community to prepare them for that happening and get buy-in from the communities?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. One of the things that I learned from working with these entomologists that go into the field and they study things like malaria is that they actually have tremendous experience with that, not flying drones, but going in and doing something around the community, putting these funny looking traps that smoke out CO2 and glow in the dark. And they say exactly the same thing, that part of getting that right is making sure the community understands why you're doing it. You know, in addition to the technical responsibility, that you make it safe, that you put in the right privacy protections. In addition to that, the community has to understand why you're doing it and approve of it. So I think that is incredibly important. One thing that has really excited me about this application is in the places where we've tried it manually, the community was incredibly receptive. When we tell them what we're trying to do is to predict when that next virus will sweep through, they totally get it. And as you saw, they let us even into their homes. That actually amazed me that, you know, we could show up at someone's home and put a trap in their laundry room. That's pretty invasive. But they understood the mission and why the technology could make a difference, and they wanted to enable us to try to make that difference. In the case of Grenada, a few months before we went, there was the emergence of a virus called chikungunya. It's something that's known to India and Africa, but had never been in the Caribbean before. It swept through all of the Caribbean, even up to the southern United States. It's mosquito-borne. When you get it, you get a viral arthritis that can last for up to 2 years. So it's a really nasty thing to get. When we went there, this community had experienced that at pretty high rates, in addition to the rest of the Caribbean. So they really, I think, understood how this technology could help them. But you're right, you know, the community needs to have that understanding. I totally agree with that point. Otherwise, it is just too, you know, why is this drone flying around my house, land dropping things, you know? But I think it, when done in the right way, in working with community, these things are possible, and people understand the point of it. That was our experience so far, at least. Yeah. I guess one, yeah, should we take one more? Yeah, let's do. Which sequencing platform? Yeah, so we used Illumina machines to do the sequencing. In this case, it was Illumina medium-seq machines. So they give about 150, I think it was 150 base pair reads. You know, we did that because, I mean, currently that's sort of the standard, and cost-wise, it's high throughput, pretty low cost. Then the upcoming nanopore devices, we haven't tested them yet, but those would give you potentially much longer reads. So by reads, I mean, just to summarize. So when you put something into a gene sequencer, it basically cuts up the genetic material into little words. So a gene can be, you know, millions of a long word that's millions of nucleic acids long. Gene sequencer cuts them up into little bits, and then it tells you, reads out to you these little bits. And then computationally, you have to reconstruct them back into the true gene. A machine that we use would return these 150 base pair words, which have to then be computationally reconstructed into longer genes. Upcoming technology can extend that to 1,000 base pairs, so you can get very long sequence of base pairs. You chop the gene up into coarser parts, which in general is good for things. So we haven't tried the nanopore technologies. It's an interesting experimental question whether they would be useful in this case, because, you know, what we're getting is genetic material that has been in the digestive system of a mosquito for maybe a day. So, you know, even we don't really know what the digestive system of a mosquito does to this genetic material. It's certainly chopping it up. So the cost-benefit trade-off is still a bit unclear. And that's part of what we're trying to work out. What is the cost-benefit trade-off so that you get the most data for the amount of money that you spend? But at some point, I think an experiment like that, or one to inform us of sort of what's the average size you need to be looking at, is something that we'll do. Yeah. Okay, cool. Thank you for the great question. So I guess I'm supposed to say there are resources. What's not on this slide is that we have a website, research.microsoft.com/premonition. We will be publishing results and putting them on the site.